I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, is estimated to affect 11 to 20% of military service members returning from Iraq or Afghanistan. University of Central Florida researcher Dr. Deborah Beidle is helping to treat these service members using smell therapy. I'll talk to her about the groundbreaking treatment, along with a former patient in the program and his therapist. Also, in the wake of the trial of George Zimmerman, Florida's Stand Your Ground law faces public scrutiny. I'll speak with Florida State House Representative Dennis Baxley, the Republican lawmaker from Ocala who crafted the 2005 House bill that led to Stand Your Ground, about the challenges the law faces in the upcoming months. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio now by Dr. Deborah Beidle. She's the director of the doctoral program in clinical psychology at the University of Central Florida and the founder of the university's Anxiety Disorders Clinic. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me here.
Joining us also is Frank Mesa. He's a graduate clinician at UCF and has been working with patients to help them overcome post-traumatic stress disorder using virtual reality and smell therapy. Frank, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And with us too is Brandon. He's asked us not to use his last name. Brandon's a veteran of Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom. He was a combat engineer in the U.S. Army's 130th Sapper Brigade, enlisting at the age of 18 and serving 18 months in the city of Mosul in Iraq. He's currently in the Army Reserve. Since returning from Iraq in 2009, Brandon was diagnosed with severe chronic PTSD. He's since gone through a course of treatment with Dr. Beidle at the University of Central Florida. Nice of you to join us, Brandon.
How are you guys doing?
Well, first of all, Dr. Beidle, post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, is estimated to affect between 11 and 20% of all veterans in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But does everyone who's been through combat or experienced some kind of trauma experience PTSD?
No, and I'm glad you asked that question. What we know for sure is that when traumatic events occur, most people have a stress reaction. So it is absolutely common for people right after a traumatic event to have difficulty sleeping, to have trouble eating, to not be able to get those images out of their minds. For most people, though, what we see is a pattern of resilience. We see people after a couple of weeks, they start sleeping better again, they start eating better again, and the images are not so salient as they were before. Mm-hmm. One of the things we do know, though, is that the closer one is to the trauma, the more likely it is that those will be the people who will develop post-traumatic stress disorder. So how close you were, if you were exactly where the traumatic event occurred, as opposed to maybe a mile away or even 5 miles away, has an impact on whether or not you will develop the disorder.
What kind of therapies are being used to treat post-traumatic stress disorder?
Well, the most effective psychological treatment is what's called exposure therapy. And exposure therapy requires putting someone in contact with the traumatic event. So a very simple example is if you were bitten by a dog and you developed a fear of dogs, in order to get around or over that fear, you have to be around a dog. Mm-hmm. So this is the same thing with these different types of traumatic events. However, as you might suspect, it's very difficult to recreate, and we would want to recreate many of the traumatic events that occur in combat. And so we have to figure out a different way other than direct contact. But it always involves exposure therapy. That's the Institute of Medicine has indicated that exposure therapy is the only empirically supported treatment for combat-related post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, talk to me now about this program involving smells. How is that a pathway to recovery from post-traumatic stress disorder?
What we know is that smells have a very important role to play in the development of any type of memory. So if you think about it, between the olfactory bulb in your nose and the amygdala and the hippocampus, which is the emotional memory part of your brain, it's a very, very short run, as we say. It's a very, very small piece of nerves that go there. And because of that, traumatic memories that involve smell become very impactful memories, they become very stubborn memories. So going back to what I said about exposure therapy, what we want to do is recreate all the elements of the trauma. So by adding in smells to sights and to sounds, we are making the exposure more powerful, mm-hmm. and therefore it will be better and help people overcome the trauma.
How do you
simulate that environment, and how do you then bring in the smell of battle as well?
Sure. What we do is, for the person to get over these traumas, they have to go back and re-experience the event that happened. So let me give you a generic example. Let's say that someone was in an IED explosion, and in that explosion, they were injured. What we would have them do is either in their mind, if they're capable of imagining it, or with the help of our virtual reality, we can recreate that situation. So we can have them imagine or see an IED explosion. We can incorporate the sounds. We have the sounds available. We can put those into the exposure therapy. And whatever smells they remembered at that time, whether it was burning rubber or diesel fuel, we can incorporate that into the actual therapy session.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do is we actually create a traumatic scene, as we call it, and that's unique and individual for anyone who's in our treatment program, and we recreate exactly what happened to them, and we keep them there for a period of time until their anxiety about that situation decreases. It's a very old scientific theory known as habituation, that after a period of time, if you're exposed to something that makes you anxious, after about 60 to 90 minutes, your anxiety will decrease. Mm-hmm. It's not a one-time treatment, but if we do it over about 15 sessions, what we find is people come in and they say, well, I still have the thought, I can still see that image, but it doesn't bother me anymore. It's not keeping me from going out and being with my friends. It's not keeping me from driving on I-4. So what we're looking for is not to erase a memory. That would be silly to say we're going to erase someone's memory, but to decouple that anxiety that goes along with that memory and give them back their lives.
Frank Mesa, let me ask you now, as a graduate clinician in this program, what's been your role in helping patients recover from PTSD?
Well, my primary role has been as a group therapist. So we have our treatment program has two components. There's the individual component that focuses on the anxiety that comes along with PTSD, and then we have a group component in which we focus on some of the other problems that come along with PTSD, so the depression, the social withdrawal, and the anger. And so my primary role has been as a group therapist, mm-hmm. Involved in the group treatment, working on those other things. Occasionally, I do also do the individual portion as well and conduct the exposure therapy sessions. But in terms of some of the things that I've seen really change, especially in some of our more successful patients, you know, they a lot of them report, you know, just becoming themselves again in terms of rebuilding their social relationships, being able to manage their anger, being able to get back into the things that they used to enjoy, like being outdoors or perhaps, you know, going out with friends, speaking with their family members again without becoming angry. So that's where we've seen a lot of the big gains. And of course, you know, reduction in anxiety.
Is the use of smell therapy significantly different from what's been done before to treat people suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder?
Yes, I think so. And I think it's a very unique aspect of our program here. We know that olfactory senses are strongly attached to memory, but I don't think it's ever been used in this fashion to treat, especially combat PTSD. It's a, you know, we share our program with lots of different people, and many have not seen a system quite like ours.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about putting somebody in a kind of an immersive environment with the sights and the sounds as well, how does that actually work?
So the visuals are fairly basic visuals, but the real part of the treatment, the VR, I would say, enhances the treatment. It's not really the treatment itself. The real treatment is whether the veteran is able to vividly imagine and become immersed in the scene. And really these other aspects of the VR, the sound, the smells, are designed to make it easier to become immersed in the scene.
Well, Brandon, I want to ask you, what happens in one of these therapy sessions? Where do you start and where do you end up?
So the first day, you show up at the clinic at about 8:30, go into your room with your therapist. You sit in a chair. Well, first off, the chair is on a subwoofer box. The chair is a little bit off the ground, so you got a little room to wiggle your feet. You get started. You start talking about your traumatic experience. You go through it, figure out which smells you want, which scenes are going to be good for your situation. Once we figured out the scene and the smells and the noises and everything that we were going to use. We just did a test run, you know, to see how it would work, if it would put me back in Iraq, or if it would put me into one of those spots where I did not want to be. When Frank had me close my eyes the first time, I started getting chest pains, and I literally almost walked out of there because it was just putting me right back in the suck, if you will.
What does that mean?
Right. The suck is like, I don't know if you've ever heard of a FOBIT, somebody who stays on the FOB, forward operating base, the mm-hmm. whole time, like a laundry specialist or something like that. I'm not pointing anybody out. And then, you know, you have the guys in the suck who don't come back to the FOB for months. That's pretty much what the suck is.
Mm-hmm. And so going through this experience of the therapy put you right back there.
Absolutely. Actually, a couple times I had to just go right back to the hotel and just kind of like grab a beer and just tell myself everything's going to be all right. I couldn't even talk to my fellow soldiers here that were taking the program with me. I just had to leave. It really, really makes you think you're there, and like it's pretty crazy.
Do you now have to sort of go back and do refreshes every so often to make sure that it sticks, or is it done?
Well, see, when I got out, I felt like $1 million, man. I really haven't had any relapse or anything like that. I don't really get mad. Like, in my head, I do, but I mean, it's not like I don't have any outbursts or anything like that. When something does tend to tick me off, I guess, I do have to go back and be like, all right, so, you know, I have to reappraise the situation and make sure, you know, I'm not going to mess anything up, I guess, because, yeah, I used to get mad.
How important is it having that extra component of what it smells like?
That first day, we did all of the senses, pretty much, you know, sight, sound, and smell. And then, you know, by the third day, we were just doing smells. And I was sitting there with my eyes closed. As soon as I would smell it, it was just, let me think. What smells did we have? We had rotting flesh.
Burning
we had
rubber.
Burning rubber. Burning gas, diesel gas.
Garbage.
Garbage. BO. Yeah, it's very important. Like I said, you know, I was using the virtual reality, all aspects, and then, you know, to just drop down to the smells and then just sit there with my eyes closed and we went over it. I'd say the smells were very important.
Some of those smells, you would hope you wouldn't experience that too often in civilian life back in the United States. But other things like, for example, garbage, would that be the kind of smell that would trigger something that would take you back to a place you didn't want to be? Say you were just going about your regular day back here in Florida?
To tell you the truth, it's happened about twice. I came across the smell of Iraq, is what I'll call it. And it stopped me right in my tracks. And I'm like, I kind of had to look around. Am I in the United States right now? Or am I back in Iraq? It put me back there real quick.
Mm-hmm. When you smell those smells now, what goes through your mind?
Every day I think about Iraq and being there and all kinds of stuff. But it's just, you know, the fact that, you know, I can sit there and smell it and be like, oh, that happened when I was in Iraq. You know, I'm totally fine just sitting here. It's not, this smell is not going to hurt me. You know, this, I'm not going to break out into combat here any second because I smell this.
I think what Brandon said is really important, because I think what you see is a flashback is defined as just an immediate re-experiencing of an event. So many veterans tell us, if they smell diesel fuel, they automatically think they're back. And I think what, as I said, what the result of the therapy is that it's no longer, oh my gosh, I'm back there. It's like, wow, that smells like what happened to me when I was back in Iraq, but I'm here, I'm in the United States, it can't hurt me anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's really what we're looking for, as I said, sort of taking away that immediate anxiety response, that immediate re-experiencing, as is known in post-traumatic stress disorder, and being able to stop and say, that smells like something that happened when I was X, is really the crucial part.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. I'm speaking to Dr. Deborah Beidle, who directs the University of Central Florida's doctoral program in clinical psychology. Also in the studio, graduate clinician Frank Mesa and Iraq war veteran Brandon. We're talking about the use of smell therapy and virtual reality to treat post-traumatic stress disorder. You can join the conversation online on Twitter or on our Facebook page. You can also send us an email, intersection@wmfe.org. Frank, I want to ask you now.
How important is it for the veterans to have people who've gone through the same thing doing the treatment as well? I mean, is that an important factor of the success of the program?
Absolutely. It's one of the differences we've noticed between our 17-week program and our 3-week program. In a 3-week program, all of the participants are housed together. They go to treatment together every day, and they all share a common experience. All their traumatic experiences may not be the same, but they've all been through something very difficult. And they rely on each other. They're able to form a tight bond with each other. They often will get together after the group sessions or in between the individual and group session and kind of just share what they're going through. And again, they're all going through the same thing, so it's a bonding experience for them. And we found that they're incredibly supportive of one another. And we don't instruct them to do that. Mm-hmm. They're free to do what they want to do. But it's something that we've noticed that they seem to naturally just kind of rely on one another for support.
Well, let me ask you, Brandon, has that helped you since the program is finished? Have you found that you've formed some bonds with people who were on this program with you?
Well, we weren't there looking for friends, first off. But, the first 2 or 3 days we split off, and there were 6 of us. So three of us went into this group and 3 of us went into this other group. And it had seemed like 3 of us were combat, and then 3 of us were sustainment brigades. Mm-hmm. But after about the 4th day, it didn't matter. We all hated the program just as much as the next guy. We all didn't want to go back the next day. We all met up for dinner every night and breakfast every morning. The doctors and stuff are here to talk to you and stuff, but they have not been there, and they don't know what it's like. And having that other soldier there who's been through it and knows what not to say or what to say at the correct moment, you know.
If I could just say, I think it's important that people know that this is a study that's funded by the Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. So we have 2 treatment programs, and they are free of charge to people who qualify. The 17-week program is a typical outpatient program. The program that we're talking about right now is a 3-week intensive treatment program, and we have people come from all over the country for that program. So it's not limited to people in Central Florida. And I do think that it is very important to have a group there, because the first couple of days are really tough. And that's what we try to tell people, that this is a hard therapy. This is not just sitting around talking about things. This is actually getting back in there. And so I think having some support is really important. And we found that it's made some difference in the success that we've had with this particular program.
Well, Dr. Bidle, how long has this program been running?
We've been running the 17-week program for about 2.5 years now, and we've mm-hmm. got another 2.5 years left on this particular funding cycle. The 3-week program is very interesting, because the first time I reported back to the Army, who is the primary source of the funding, the colonel in charge said, "I think your program is going to do wonderful." He said, "But it doesn't really help me for my active duty soldiers. I can't have my active duty soldiers out of treatment for 17 weeks. And I said, "Well, you know, exposure therapy works better when the sessions are very close together." And mm-hmm. so he gave us additional funding to have this 3-week program. And we're the only place in the country that this 3-week program is available. We're very proud of being able to do that, to provide that assistance.
Well, let me ask you, Brandon, how are things for you now? You feel like you're on a better path now that you've gone through this treatment?
Absolutely. I started college. I got a brand new job. My car broke down, but we can fix that. I talk to my parents now. I'm starting to get a bunch of my old friends back. I don't have any kind of like outbursts like I used to. I don't freak out when I'm driving at like trash or anybody getting close to the car. I only lock 1 deadbolt on the door now instead of all of them. Now I'm able to, you know, have friends, talk to people and stuff. So it's nice. I like it.
I've been speaking about post-traumatic stress disorder with Brandon, a U.S. Army veteran of Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom. Thanks for speaking with us.
No problem.
Thanks also to Frank Mesa, who's a graduate clinician at the University of Central Florida, who's been working with patients suffering from PTSD.
My pleasure.
And Dr. Deborah Beidle, the director of the doctoral program in clinical psychology at the University of Central Florida and founder of the university's Anxiety Disorders Clinic. Thank you, Dr. Beidle.
Thank you very much for having us.
Up next, a conversation with Florida State House Representative Dennis Baxley on the future of Florida's Stand Your Ground law. Florida's Stand Your Ground law, a self-defense law that grants individuals the right to use justifiable force without retreating, has been thrust again into the national spotlight after the acquittal of George Zimmerman in the shooting of unarmed 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. Now, while Zimmerman and his defense team waived a pretrial Stand Your Ground immunity hearing, civil rights activists and gun control opponents are calling for another look at the Florida statute. To talk more about Stand Your Ground, I'm joined now in the studio by Florida House Representative Dennis Baxley. Representative Baxley is a Republican from Ocala, and he was the sponsor of the Stand Your Ground legislation in the Florida House in 2005. Representative Baxley, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, first of all, this was not tried as a Stand Your Ground case, but there was reference to Stand Your Ground in the jury instructions. Was the intention of Stand Your Ground legislation to be used in a case like George Zimmerman's?
Well, first of all, I'd say always remember, no matter where you place the foul line, there are going to be tough calls near the foul line, and this is one of those cases that was very tough to call. You know, I was first told, well, he can't be charged because of your statute. And I said, absolutely. If there's nothing in the statute that says you can confront, provoke another person. And yet he was charged, so I was clearly supported in my judgment on that. And not only was he charged, he was prosecuted. And obviously the questions about the responsibility on complying with this law to stand your ground were in question because they did not request the pretrial hearing. So that's really, standing your ground is all about not being prosecuted. Now, clearly the judge read our statute, our self-defense statute, for clarity to these jurors. But they really looked at all the facts in the case. Mm-hmm. And I think what unfolded, if you followed all of this, and of course I was watching it intently to see, would our concept be utilized? Would it be challenged? I was kind of surprised, quite frankly, or informed at least, when I saw that they didn't choose that route. So obviously thought there was some vulnerability on making that case, that position about standing your ground and not fleeing.
Were you surprised to see that end up in the jury instructions, though, at any rate?
No, I think they should quote the statute correctly as to what the parameters are. But actually, you don't have a duty to retreat if you're pinned to the ground. And they presented a case that I think convinced the jury this was the posture he was in ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
And but I also think that what goes down before or after does matter. I think this became such a large phenomena, not because of Stand Your Ground, not because of Florida's law, but simply because it pulled the hide back on a more underlying issue, and that is, are we all treated equally before the law and in our culture, which is our ideals?
Mm-hmm.
And how well are we doing with that?
How well would you say we're doing, Representative?
Well, we're not there yet. I mean, having high ideals leaves room for us to grow and improve. And as I said, you know, if I was a young man and I was dealt with suspicion like that, I would be angered. But the bad decision was not to do what you have a right to do, which is walk down the street and go home,
mm-hmm.
but instead being angered and reacting in a way that you came back for the fight, which turned out horribly.
The issue of repeal, I know that's been talked about by opponents of this law, but realistically, what are the chances of that happening in the Florida legislature?
I think you're going to find an atmosphere where we're all very cautious. It's very easy in a phenomena setting in a case like this to react, and when you got to go do something. And that's a lot of times when we make policy errors. And so I think we're all cautious about doing it's important to listen. It's important for people to talk about this. It's important to look at data. It's important to get better data. But then we need to make real good policy decisions. And I think most people still look at the data like I do and believe, you know, we're really safer if we empower people to stop violent acts.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you, too, about some of the broader implications of this debate that's been going on since this verdict. We've had, for example, the likes of musician Stevie Wonder calling for a boycott of the entire state, other people saying they're not going to perform or not going to come to Florida while the Stand Your Ground law is on the books. Do these boycotts have any kind of impact?
Well, I certainly don't think it's the way to set public policy. You know, we should set public policy on what's the right and fair way to operate our criminal justice system, not because an entertainer doesn't want to come to Florida. But no, I don't think those kind of boycotts and that kind of language is benefiting anyone. Matter of fact, it's going to hurt a lot of the people he's trying to benefit.
Well, what about the idea of education? Now, this is something that came out of the task force you were part of, which went statewide last year and looked at Stand Your Ground, that you talked to folks from both sides of the aisle, both sides of the issue, and came up with some recommendations. And education of law enforcement, the judicial arm, other folks was part of that. What's happening with that? What kind of education is there underway at the moment to help people understand this statute better?
I think this whole dialogue in this around this case has strengthened understanding of what this statute is and what it is not. And I think that it also has made people look at real numbers. I know I'm looking at real numbers saying, do we have the right policy or not? I want to make sure I'm correct. If we've got data that supports our policy, then that's what we should do.
Well, let me just ask you, finally, Representative Baxley, I mean, some people have asked for a special session to be called to discuss the Stand Your Ground legislation. Is that likely to happen, do you think? I know that Governor Rick Scott has indicated probably not, but do you think the legislature could meet to discuss this law?
I don't find that meaningful because we have a process by which to hear ideas. You know, any legislator can file legislation. That initiates a discussion. People say, well, we want to have the debate. Well, when you file a bill, you're going to have debate. That doesn't mean we're going to hear the bill in committee. It doesn't mean that we're going to pass it. But you can have the debate simply starting a discussion by how you file legislation, and I fully expect that will happen this year. And we may find some better things to do, but under the present circumstance, if you open a statute on the floor, you don't know what may get amended to or filed or added to that discussion. If you value this protection for our law-abiding citizens, then you better be cautious about what you bring out onto the floor, either in committee or chamber.
I've been speaking with Florida State House Representative Dennis Baxley. Representative Baxley is a Republican from Ocala. He sponsored the 2005 Stand Your Ground legislation in the Florida House. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.